Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. That war has a component that most of us, frankly, have not recognized really is increasingly a part of the war for the free world, a struggle underway in the Western Pacific and, to some degree, far beyond, as a result of the rising power, on the one hand, of communist China, and on the other, the apparent waning power and influence of the United States in the region and arguably elsewhere. I'm very pleased to say we have an opportunity to spend a full hour exploring these developments, the trends, the implications for the future, with the author of a brand spanking new book entitled Fire on the Water, China, America, and the Future of the Pacific. He is Robert Haddock, a man with a distinguished background, a lot of expertise brought to bear for this purpose. Currently, he serves as a contractor at U.S. Special Operations Command. He formerly was a Marine Corps officer with service in Asia and Africa. He has been advising the State Department, the National Intelligence Council, U.S. Central Command, and he's also published extensively on this subject, including as a managing editor of Small Wars Journal and also This Week at War column for foreign policy. Robert Haddock, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us, sir, and congratulations on the new book, Fire on the Water.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be here.
We're going to spend a full hour with you, I'm very pleased to say, and have an opportunity really to drill down on various aspects of your analysis and quite worrying conclusions, I think it's fair to say. But set the stage for us, if you would, Robert. What is Fire on the Water, and why should we in the United States and indeed the free world be concerned about it?
Well, Frank, Fire on the Water is about bringing to a general audience in the West growing security challenge that the United States and its allies in the region face as a result of China's return as a great power. And China's return as a great power is creating and accelerating clashed interests in the Asia-Pacific region and in the Western Pacific. And this is a challenge, bringing a challenge to the 7 decades of U.S. forward presence in that region, which is had a great record of creating stability and prosperity for all, but the disruptive rise of China now is bringing that remarkable 7-decade success story under threat, and the U.S. Government's response to these changing conditions has been faltering and needs to change, and I describe all that in my book.
Well, we're going to talk about it in the course of our hour. Robert Haddock, the idea, I guess, of a rising China being a non-threatening development, something that can be peaceable, something that can be managed, and need not constitute a threat to what you just described, which I think has been popularly called Pax Americana, a wildly successful contribution to stability and prosperity and growth in a very important part of the world, the East Asia, the Western Pacific, and so on. Is it basically your thesis in your new book that China's rise is anything but peaceful, and that at least the kind of management of that, if you could call it, that we've been undertaking to this point is really a delusion rather than something that's been the least bit effective?
Well, that's a great question, Frank. China, it's been 3 decades since Deng Xiaoping's policy to open up China to the global economy began, During those three decades, China enjoyed extremely rapid economic growth. And with that economic growth, China acquired economic ties, deepening economic ties with the rest of the world. And then that, in turn, caused China to have growing stakes, growing interests around the world that it needed to defend. And now more recently, so during the first part of this three-decade period, China's cooperation with the international order and norms had, as they had been known and followed for the most part, was pretty strong, and China was not considered to be a threat. But lately, over the past few years, 2008 especially, China's belligerence, its assertiveness, its aggressiveness has accelerated. And so now China has a much more worrying attitude about how it's going to protect its interests, and that it's creating a lot of concern among U.S. allies in the region.
Yeah. I want to come to its behavior with you in a moment, but maybe we could start before getting to that point with a bit more detail, Robert Haddock, about the buildup that China has engaged in. It's what's really enabling this aggressive behavior. And I'm sure in the course of our conversation over this hour, we'll spin off into various aspects of it. But just at the macro level, how would you characterize what China has been able to manage? You've addressed its economic growth and rise, of course, but talk a little bit, if you would, about how it has accompanied that economic rise with a really massive sort of reconstitution, modernization, and aggregation of power projection capabilities in particular.
Well, China's military modernization program, Frank, has been breathtaking. It began two decades ago in the early to mid-1990s after two notable events. Well, actually, three notable events occurred. First, the 1991 Persian Gulf War. Chinese officials and military officers observed the dramatic effectiveness of the U.S. Military technical revolution, stealth aircraft, precision weapons, sophisticated targeting and command and control system that the U.S. and the coalition was able to deploy against the Iraqi military. So that alarmed People's Liberation Army officers, and they knew at that time that they needed to catch up, do something to catch up with the West. Well, the next thing that happened was the 1996 Taiwan Strait crisis, which was China's attempt to bully the Taiwanese electorate during presidential elections that occurred in March of that year, 1996. China conducted missile tests into the Taiwan Strait and so forth during the electoral period. The U.S. responded by sending two carrier strike groups, aircraft carrier strike groups, to the region, and Chinese officials concluded after that episode that they would build specific military capabilities to make sure that they would never again be subject to U.S. military intimidation in that fashion. So that was another impetus for the rapid Chinese military modernization program that happened after that.
Yeah. So these are practical steps that the Chinese have taken, informed by what they've seen in terms of, 21st century military capabilities that the United States was bringing to bear.
Right.
And that has been sort of underpinning a strategy of China's reassertion of what it considers to be its rightful place in the world, the Middle Kingdom, the center of the universe, and all that. And we're going to pause here for just a moment with Robert Haddock to come back and visit at greater length about how these various insights have translated into an array of new and very formidable capabilities to deny access, as it said. It's a somewhat antiseptic term, but basically to defeat the United States military in the Western Pacific. That and more with the author of Fire on the Water, China, America, and the Future of the Pacific, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there, America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back for a very special conversation with the author of a brand new book from an outfit that published one of mine, I'm very happy to say, Naval Institute Press. It's called Fire on the Water, China, America, and the Future of the Pacific. He is Robert Haddock, a former United States Marine Corps officer in Asia, among other duty assignments, and a man now advising, among others, the U.S. Special Operations Command. You may be familiar with his writings because they appear in places like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Air and Space Power Journal. He also formerly was the managing editor of a terrific outfit, Small Wars Journal. Robert, we've been talking a little bit in the first segment about megatrends. Talk, if you would, now briefly about how it is that China seems to be guiding the military buildup you just described. What is its purpose and implications?
Well, China's purpose is to be able to exclude U.S. expeditionary forces, naval task forces, U.S. air power, and so forth, from being able to operate within 2,000 kilometers of China's coast. And they're going to accomplish this through a very smart, well-designed military modernization plan, which I mentioned has been underway for two decades now, but continues on. They're exploiting what I call the missile and sensor revolution. Missiles, anti-ship, anti-aircraft, land attack missiles, ballistic and cruise, that are extremely accurate, and then a sensor network and a command and control network to coordinate and control all those missile forces. And China's missile power continues to expand and is placing U.S. bases and surface ships in the Western Pacific under increasing threat.
And that's translating now into an array of capabilities that really are quite striking in both their comprehensiveness and their sophistication, especially given our vulnerabilities. We're visiting with Robert Haddock. He is a contractor with U.S. Special Operations Command with a background in the United States Marine Corps that informs his new book, Fire on the Water, China, America, and the Future of the Pacific. And Robert, you were talking a bit about the kinds of capabilities that China has put into place. Give us a sense of how that really spans the sort of various domains from, as you say, missile and sensor technology through the various asymmetric warfare capabilities, including space and even nuclear capabilities.
Sure. Well, China's access denial, anti-access area denial, missile forces, well, they come in a few different forms. First, the one part that probably gets the most publicity is something called the DF-21D missile. It's a medium-range ballistic missile. But China is mastering the technology to put on a maneuvering, targeted warhead on this ballistic missile that will give it the ability to attack a U.S. warship underway in the Western Pacific.
Particularly something like our aircraft carriers, presumably,
which
are the highest value assets we have, arguably, out there.
Exactly. This is something that no other country has attempted to master, and China seems well on the way to fielding it. There are certain vulnerabilities with the system architecture to make the system work. China needs a sophisticated space-based surveillance and communication network and so forth. But, you know, by 2020, China's space capabilities will be equal to that of the United States. I mean, they have the same kind of satellite communication networks, space-based radar, satellite observation satellites, and so forth.
They also may have a considerably better ability to get into space than we do, given the emphasis they've been placing on that and the relative lack of it on our part.
Right, and then, of course, China has very robust counter space capability,
yes.
the ability to bring down adversary satellites.
Let me ask you about one other piece of this, Robert. And again, I want to sort of put this in the context of its unmistakable hostility towards the United States. We're looking at a China that has massively invested in its nuclear forces. In fact, one of the most striking things to me that's largely gone unremarked has been an investment by the Chinese in some 3,000 miles of hardened underground tunnels in which we believe they have been placing modern ballistic missile, nuclear-armed ballistic missile forces. Give us a sense when against that backdrop, we hear the Chinese publicly boasting about their ability to attack American cities, killing millions of Americans with submarine-launched ballistic missiles as well, and many more with the radiation fallout flowing downwind. Is it their purpose explicitly to threaten this country, in your judgment?
Well, I think over time that's going to become more and more evident, and I think they see the United States as being a rival power in the Western Pacific. I think it's pretty clear, undeniable, that they would like to exclude, eventually be able to have the comprehensive power to exclude U.S. influence from Western Pacific and from China's neighborhood there.
And, no, I get that. But do you uh-huh. consider what they're doing, Robert, to be actually in design, not simply to, keep us out of what they consider to be, their sovereign waters and airspace, but actually to put us at mortal risk if we dare to impinge upon those areas?
Well, I think having this nuclear capability that you described is part of creating a situation called escalation dominance, mm-hmm. where they will have the ability to be able to thwart any U.S. Ability to control a crisis situation or be able to intimidate China through escalation, as the U.S. successfully did in March of 1996. So creating this escalation dominance for China involves creating military capabilities all along the spectrum, including the nuclear forces that you mentioned.
Yeah. And there's one other piece of it, and we may have to come back to this, but just very quickly, I was impressed by a book that was published, I believe, back in 1999 by two Chinese PLA colonels, People's Liberation Army colonels, entitled Unrestricted Warfare. I don't know if you're familiar with this book, Robert, but this was really a blueprint for engaging in massively destructive attacks against the United States using a whole host of things, including electromagnetic pulse and economic warfare and on and on. How does that fit into this overall construct as you see it, very quickly?
Well, yes, I agree with that. And I think that the theories put in unrestricted warfare are in Chinese doctrine now. And this brings up an interesting point very quickly. My book, Fire in the Water, I call for an analogous broad portfolio of U.S. capabilities in order to be able to influence Chinese.
Well, hold that thought, because we're going to come back and drill down on that big time in the successive two segments that we have left with Robert Haddock, as he mentioned, the author most recently of Fire on the Water, China, America, and the Future of the Pacific. Specifically, we're going to talk about, does it matter who controls the Pacific? Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. U.S. warplanes and cruise missiles have begun attacking Islamic State targets in Syria. They've been joined by aircraft from several Arab nations, including, curiously, from Qatar. The Qatari contribution to this air campaign is symptomatic of the strategic morass in which we now find ourselves. Qatar is arguably the country that has been the world's most aggressive international supporter of jihadists. Among its contributions to the global jihad have been underwriting, enabling, and providing ideological leadership to the Muslim Brotherhood, financing al-Qaeda, hosting the Taliban, including the five commanders illegally released from Guantanamo by President Obama, operating the jihadist propaganda arm, Al Jazeera, and supporting rebels in Syria, apparently including some it is now bombing. With friends like Qatar, America will have no shortage of enemies. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement? And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back visiting with Robert Haddock, a man who has provided distinguished service to the United States military as a Marine Corps officer and now as a contractor for U.S. Special Operations Command. He has also written widely as a managing editor of Small Wars Journal, as the columnist at Foreign Policy, This Week at War, and in various other outlets, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Air and Space Journal, among others. He is the author of a book we are discussing, I'm very pleased to say, for this full hour. It's entitled Fire on the Water, China, America, and the Future of the Pacific. And you have a chapter in this book, Robert, that it just seems to me very nicely captures what we need to be thinking hard about. You entitle it, It Matters, Who Runs the Pacific. Talk a little bit about why.
Well, the Asia-Pacific area, the Western Pacific, East Asia, are critical to the success of the United States. They're critical to the U.S. standard of living, to the U.S. economy. Nearly 10% of U.S. Production and output is sold to customers in the Asia-Pacific region. It supports millions and millions of U.S. jobs. It's important for U.S. workers, for consumers, investors. It's the fastest growing economic region on the planet. It's the U.S. has to participate in that in order to increase the U.S. standard of living in the future. It's essential for U.S. growth. Now, the forward presence that the U.S. has maintained in the region since World War II for seven decades, as we mentioned earlier, has helped this region, the Asia-Pacific region, be perhaps the greatest economic and social success story on the planet during that period of time. So that it's evidence that the U.S. forward presence matters for U.S. interests.
And they are clearly, as you've indicated, making clear they regard this as a zero-sum game, as they say in the political science of academia, namely that where we have the ability to run and influence things in the Pacific, it is at their expense, and when they can assert power and keep us out, it is obviously to their benefit and at our expense. And this presumably, Robert, has been informing the president's recent pronouncements about a pivot to China, or excuse me, to pivot to Asia, I should say, more broadly, supposedly not threatening to China specifically. But give us a flavor of how real that is. Talk a little bit about what you call America's archaic military machine in the Pacific, and whether that's being modified at all as a result of the Obama pivot.
Right. Well, the one thing I do agree with the Obama administration on is that I think it's the priority given to Asia is important for U.S. interests for reasons I just mentioned. I think it's important to also understand that the region is not likely to be able to maintain stability on its own. It's not going to, if the U.S. was not there, it's unlikely that Asia would be able to find a stable balance of power on its own, similar to the way Europe was not able to before World War I, for example. Now, the U.S. has maintained its forward military presence in the region, but has not. The U.S. military planners and policymakers and so forth have not adapted to the growing missile and sensor revolution that China is exploiting and is increasingly using its missile power to threaten the forward-basing system that the U.S. has maintained in the region for all these decades. So that part, the Obama administration announced the pivot to Asia, but it has there's been no follow through. There haven't been any practical programs, policies, adjustments, adaptations to make it anything other than just words at this point.
Empty words. Well, they point to things like putting some number of your fellow Marines through training ops in Australia, for example, as a kind of response. And I gather that you believe the Chinese regard this as sort of paper tiger behavior rather than a real response to their kinds of capabilities. And you know, I'm struck, there's so many pieces of this that I'd love to develop with you, but let's just touch a few, Robert, before we have to take another break. We had in China an industrial base buildup that is not only accompanying, it's making possible much of the military buildup that that you've described. I've had, among other things, Mark Helprin on the show to talk a bit about the massive expansion of the number of shipyards, for example, that the Chinese now can use to build, well, seagoing vessels of various kinds, at the moment perhaps mostly commercial vessels, but at will, naval combatants. Contrasting that with a handful of what's left on our part, we're no near where we were, say, World War II, where we could crank out a ship a day for the purposes of maintaining our, you know, power projection capabilities and ultimately winning the war. Give us a sense of how that factors into it. It's not just the military forces themselves. It's sort of the, well, I think of it as a war footing that the Chinese have put themselves on, and we are nowhere near that.
China is a very impressive industrial power. They've got great scientific and engineering talent there. They are producing their own versions of the SU-27 Flanker, very successful fighter-bomber aircraft. They'll have over 400 flanker variants by the year 2020. They'll be armed with supersonic, highly precise anti-ship cruise missiles, which have a range of 400 kilometers. This is actually a bigger threat to U.S. surface forces than the DF-21D anti-ship ballistic missile.
Just and because of the sheer numbers of them?
Sheer numbers of them, but the range of the flanker plus the, say, YJ-12 missile greatly exceeds that of U.S. aircraft. Mm. So the U.S. suffers from a real range problem out there. And then very quickly on the shipbuilding submarine side, the Chinese diesel-electric submarines, very quiet, stealthy, and the Chinese by the year 2020, the Chinese submarine force will outnumber the U.S. Pacific Fleet submarine force by over 2-1.
Yeah, and as I recall, it was Stalin who said that quantity has a quality all its own. But as well, as you know, Robert Haddock, we've seen the Chinese improving the quality of these forces as well as their quantity, in part by ripping off ours.
Right. Their industrial espionage effort is well known. China gets its military technology from a variety of sources, both from its espionage effort, but from its homegrown engineering and scientific talent, which is increasingly formidable.
And I guess what I'm trying to get at is what you're documenting, Robert Haddock, in your new book, Fire on the Water, is really a sea change, if I can use that expression. And yet we're hearing from the commander of U.S. forces in the Pacific, for example, the greatest threat he faces in his command is climate change.
Uh-huh.
When we come back, we're going to talk further about whether we are actually taking the sorts of steps we must to contend with what is clearly emerging in the way of an ever more hostile and aggressive China, if only for the purposes of deterring the sorts of conduct that can bring not just our friends and allies in the Western Pacific great grief, but us as well. Again, that'll be our final and fourth segment with Robert Haddock, the author of Fire on the Water, China, America, and the Future of the Pacific, an incredibly important and most timely book when we see the buildup from the Chinese and the relative paucity of responses out of our own country. That and more with Robert Haddock right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I lost my arm.
I lost my legs.
But you can't see what I lost. Over 625,000 vets are suffering from traumatic brain injury
and post-traumatic stress. They're the wounds you can't see.
But with your help, we can expose the invisible wounds of war.
And get these veterans the help they desperately need.
100% of your donation goes toward building treatment centers. Help heal the invisible wounds of war. Donate at makeitvisible.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at DailyCaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for our final segment. Time is flying by, and the conversation has been fascinating with Robert Haddock, former Marine Corps officer, now a contractor at U.S. Special Operations Command, whose new book from the Naval Institute Press is required reading. If you're interested in the fate of the free world. This is entitled Fire on the Water, China, America, and the Future of the Pacific. You may be familiar with his writings from various other outlets, including Foreign Policy, where he wrote the This Week at War column. You also can find his writings in places like the New York Times and Wall Street Journal. And Robert, you've set a table that is, somewhat discouraging, shall we say, in terms of how the Chinese have been amassing over decades. And not least with our help in important respects, including, of course, our investment, our trade, and in some cases, are supplying them, unwillingly mostly, advanced technologies that they've simply been ripping off and thereby using to improve their military capabilities at a fraction of the cost. You've also talked about the relative inadequacy of our military capabilities in light of this growing threat. Give us a flavor of what you have laid out in Fire on the Water should be America's policy and programmatic response to the emerging threat from China.
Well, Frank, let me give you a broad overview, and then we can talk about some of the specifics. First, the goal here should be to influence Chinese behavior in a favorable direction. In other words, the U.S. And its allies need a broad toolbox of levers, of tools to be able to influence Chinese behavior, talking about diplomatic tools, political tools, media and propaganda, economic tools, and then, of course, military tools also that will influence Chinese behavior in a peacetime security competition in the region. The military tools should be conventional and unconventional in nature. So that's what's going to be required. This could be one of the most difficult security challenges the U.S. Has ever faced, just because of the sheer size of the Chinese economy. It'll be much larger than the Soviet economy, and their ability to be able to produce hard power is something that the U.S. hasn't faced in a long, long time.
Yeah. You know, one of the other pieces of this, we touched earlier with you about the challenges that we're facing with respect to our relative industrial capabilities. One other facet of this, and I think it's so important to understand when you lay out, as you just did, the need for a kind of comprehensive approach, both economic and technological and military, is the dependency we now have, both for our civilian economy and to a considerable degree for our military, on Chinese sources of supply. Talk a little bit about that. Rare earth minerals comes to mind as a particularly egregious example.
Well, it's interesting. We're, Frank, we're now recognizing the two centuries since the War of 1812. That was the last time, the War of 1812, where the U.S. fought a war against a country and an economy that it was very tightly integrated with. And now we're in a security competition also now with China, a country that we're tightly integrated with financially, economically, and so forth. And this is sort of a disorienting thing for U.S. policymakers, something they're not used to.
But well, in fact, there's this widespread belief that because we are so related economically, that they couldn't possibly threaten us. You don't buy that, I take it.
Well, that didn't work before World War One. That was the theory 100 years ago as to why war in Europe was illogical. But security will always trump economics.
And especially when you're dealing with what remains, at the very least, an authoritarian regime, if not actually a totalitarian one, that has, as we talk about a lot here at Secure Freedom Radio, Robert Haddock, notably with Gordon Chang, its own internal difficulties and dynamics, which may well prompt it to seek, as has often been done by others like them, a safety valve in foreign conflicts or adventurism, blaming, an external threat for their need for internal repression. Do you regard that as, again, an impetus and a requirement for us to take the sorts of steps that you're calling for here, lest we be not only less than prepared to deal with this Chinese threat, but in actually inviting it?
Well, China has vulnerabilities, which our strategy, a new strategy, which I describe in the book, should seek to exploit. China's growing nationalism may be something that Xi Jinping and the standing committee of the Politburo and so forth, they're using as a means of social control and stirring up anger against foreigners may be part of the nationalist tool that the Chinese leadership is using to maintain social control in the future. But this represents a could be part of a vulnerability or an exposure, a weakness that the strategy should recognize and fashion ways to exploit, to be able to hold at risk assets and conditions that are highly valued by China's leaders in order to get their guide their behavior in conditions, in directions that are favorable to our interests.
Yeah, this is, of course, it goes without saying, all the more challenging for an America that is at the moment cutting its military capabilities, and to the extent that it still musters a substantial military force, is largely preoccupied with challenges elsewhere. I'm not sure that's an accident, comrade. I'm particularly struck, as I said earlier, by the fact that in the Pacific, we have the commander of our forces out there saying it's not the Chinese that are his biggest problem, it's climate change. I'd be very interested in its early days because Fire on the Water has just come out earlier this month. But tell me, Robert Haddock, what kind of response you've gotten so far from those out in Pacific Command or elsewhere in the United States government to both your analysis of what this Chinese threat is and your urging for corrective action on our part.
Well, the response has been very good and gratifying so far, especially the responses I get from mid-level field grade officers and so forth from the various services who talk to me quietly. They're happy to see something like this out now and getting this debate conversation going.
Well, it's about time, needless to say, and I hope, Robert, that it will in fact inform a real debate, and that debate will lend itself to the sorts of recommended actions that you've described. And I think it's so interesting, and as a former field graded officer yourself, I know you know those are the guys the closest to the pointy end of the spear, and I put a lot more confidence in their assessment of these things than I do their often highly politicized senior commanders, notably out at PACCOM. But I really want to take the last 30 seconds to just say how much I appreciate both this important new work, Fire on the Water, China, America, and the Future of the Pacific, and the contribution that I pray it will make, Robert Haddock, to the debate that is long overdue in this country and urgently needed in the Pacific specifically. That context is most urgent, but it more generally as well. We thank you for joining us, and I hope you'll come back to us again soon. This is clearly a critically important time and topic, and your insights into it are deeply appreciated. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.